sukam
asinam
asinam
viśantam sukam asinam viśantam sukam asinam
viśantam sukam asinam
vaprachu
vaprachu
ayubhagata
ayubhagata
vaprachu ayubhagata
vaprachu ayubhagata
Aprachu payupagata
Aprachu payupagata
Vishwantam sukhamashinam
Vishwantam sukhamashinam
Aprachu payupagata
Aprachu payupagata
Samupetyata gopalam
Samupetyata gopalam
Asya hastagahadibi
Asya hastagahadibi
Vishwantam sukhamasinam
Vishwantam sukhamasinam
Paprachu paryupagataha
Paprachu paryupagataha
Oparvidansha vidivad
Oparvidansha vidivad
Yavishtara vivandita
Yavishtara vivandita
Yatavayo yatasakyam
Yatavayo yatasakyam
Yatasambandham atmana Gopalam
Samupetyata Gopalam
Asya Hastagahadibhi
Asya Hastagahadibhi
Vishwantam Sukhamasinam
Vishwantam Sukhamasinam
Aprachu Kayupagataha
Aprachu Kayupagataha
Gopavidansha Vivivad
Gopavidansha Vivivad
Yavishtara Vivandita
Yavishtara Vivandita
Sakyam
Yathavayo Yathasakyam
Yathasambandhamatmana
Yathasambandhamatmana
Samupetyata Gopalam
Samupetyata Gopalam
Asya Hastagrahadibhi
Asya Hastagrahadibhi
Vishrantam Sukham Asinam
Vishrantam Sukham Asinam
Aprachur Vayubhagata
Aprachur Vayubhagata
Gopavridam cha vidivad
Gopavridam cha vidivad
Yavishtair abhivanditaha
Yavishtair abhivanditaha
Yatavayo yatasakyam
Yatavayo yatasakyam
Yatasambandhamatmanaha
Yatasambandhamatmanaha
Samupetyata gopalam
Samupetyata gopalam
Asya hastagahadibhi
Asya hastagahadibhi
Vishrantam sukhamasinam
Vishrantam sukhamasinam
Paprachu paryupagataha
Paprachu paryupagataha
Vishwantam
sukhamasinam
Aprachu
And this one of us. Christas chana mayam seshu prema gadradaya vira krishne kamala patrakshe sanyastakira ravasam. Transliteration. Gopa.
Gopa.
Of the cowherds.
Of the cowherds.
Vidhan.
Vidhan.
The elders.
The elders.
Cha.
Cha.
And. Vidivat.
Vidivat.
In accordance with Vedic injunctions.
In accordance with Vedic injunctions.
Yavishai.
Yavishai.
By those who are younger.
By those who are younger.
It's interesting to hear this point in Vidivat, because as we discuss this, you'll see the relevance of it. But it's sort of talking about, in the next word it says, Abhivandita, respectfully greeted. So it's talking about the way that Balaram would greet everyone. And it's very interesting, it says that it's according to Vedic injunctions. Abhivandita,
Abhivandita,
respectfully greeted.
Yatavaya, Yatavaya,
according to age. It's okay, it's a little loud. The battery's fine. Yatasakyam,
Yatasakyam,
according to friendship.
According to friendship.
Yatasambhanam,
Yatasambhanam.
So, Yatasambhanam,
Yatasambhanam.
Making it up, putting an extra syllable in there. According to family relationship. So just a few points here. It says according to age. Now obviously there's you know, if someone's a certain age, then there's people of the same age as you, there's people that are older than you, and there's people that are younger than you. And you interact with those people according to that age difference. So also saying here according to friendship. So there's also different types of friends. There's like, you have like suhit, which means it's a well-wishing friend, just like we see here in the Gita, suhidam sarvadehinam, that Krishna, he's the supreme well-wishing friend of all his entities. Then we have bandhu, which is like friends, you know, or as we say in Australia, mates. Yeah? And then you have mitra. Mitra means this is a friend, but not so intimate. You sort of know and have association. So according to friendship, there's also relationship is there. And then it says, yata sambhan. According to family relationships. So, you know, in the family you have parents, you have children, you have brothers and sisters, and you have older brothers and sisters, younger brothers and sisters. There's all these different types of relationships in there. Atmana.
Atmana.
With himself.
With himself.
Samupetya.
Samupetya.
Going up to.
Going up to.
Tata.
Tata.
Then.
Then.
Gopalam.
Gopalam.
The cowherd men.
Hasya,
hasya, with smiles.
With smiles.
Hastagraha,
hastagraha,
taking of their hands.
Taking of their hands.
Hasta means hands. Adibi,
adibi,
and on.
And on.
Vishrantam,
vishrantam,
rested.
Rested.
Sukham,
sukham,
comfortably.
Comfortably.
Asinam,
asinam,
seated,
seated.
Paprachu,
paprachu,
they ask,
they ask.
Kayupagataha,
kayupagataha,
having gathered on all sides.
Having gathered on all sides.
Krishtaha,
krishtaha,
questioned,
questioned.
Cha,
cha,
and
anamayam,
anamayam, about health.
Sveshu,
Sveshu, in regard to their dear friends.
In regard to their dear friends.
Prema,
prema,
out of love.
Out of love.
Gadgadaya,
Gadgadaya,
faltering.
Faltering.
You know this word appears? First we chant regularly.
Shakespeare?
Yeah. Okay, the seventh verse of the Shastakam. Faltering. They're saying in Gira, the same thing. Gagira Gira with faltering voice. Same phrase. Gira
Gira
with voices.
With voices.
Krishna,
Krishna,
or Krishna,
or Krishna,
Kamala,
Kamala,
of a lotus,
of a lotus,
Patra,
Patra,
like, petals,
Akshay,
whose eyes, Patra Akshay, eyes of lotus petals, eyes shaped like lotus petals, very nice. Sanyasta,
having dedicated,
Akila,
all,
Radasa,
material possessions.
It'd be interesting name for some Patraksha, and I was like those tales. Lord Balaram. Okay, translation. Lord Balaram then paid proper respects to the elder cowherd men, and the younger ones all greeted him respectfully. He met them all with smiles, handshakes, and so on, dealing personally with each one according to age, degree of friendship, and family relationship. Then after resting, the Lord accepted a comfortable seat, and they all gathered around him. With voices faltering out of love for him, those cowherds who had dedicated everything to lotus-eyed Krishna asked about the health of the dear ones in Dwaraka, and Balaram in turn asked about the cowherds' welfare. Responsibly, please.
Lord Balaram
then paid proper respects to the elder cowherd men. And the younger ones all greeted him respectfully. He met them all with smiles.
Handshakes and so on.
Dealing personally with each one according to age.
Degree of friendship.
And family relationship.
Then after resting,
The Lord accepted a comfortable seat. And they all gathered around him. With voices faltering out of love for him.
Those cowherds.
Who had dedicated everything to lotus-eyed Krishna. Asked about the health of their dear ones in Dwaraka. And Balaram in turn asked about the cowherd's welfare. So we see here in this verse, it's discussing how when Lord Balaram he returned to Vrindavan, the way he interacted or greeted everyone. And we see this is quite common in Vedic culture, just like we see when Krishna, when he came to Hastinapur, he went to Hastinapur from Dwarka and he met with the Pandavas. So he offered his respects to Yudhisthira Maharaj, because Yudhisthira, by position and by age, was senior. And also Bhima was senior. Arjuna was considered his equal, so he embraced Arjuna. And then the twins Nakula and Sahadeva, they bowed down before Krishna and touched his feet. Krishna was touching Yudhisthira's feet. Same with Kunti. He bowed down to Kunti. He touched her feet. So we see that even the Supreme Lord, when it comes to these dealings like this, in these formal dealings, he follows the Vedic etiquette. And as it's saying here, it says Vidivat, that in accordance with the Vedic injunctions. And it's not that, like we see in this day and age, the way people interact tends to be, according to their own speculations. They actually don't understand the relationships. And it's not just like it's an arbitrary thing. It's not just that it's, it sounds good, so we do it like that. There is a purpose behind this. By understanding, by dealing with a person properly, it means we understand the relationship. Relationships are a very important thing. If we understand a relationship between one person and another, between one item and another, then we know how to utilize these things properly in the material world to help us in our spiritual advancement. I'll give you an example. Just like, we're worshipping the deity. What is the relationship between us and the deity? What is the mood we take? Huh? Hmm. And what is that called Sanskrit?
Das.
Yeah, Dasharas. This is the mood of a servant. So the mood of a servant is they just stand there with folded hands, waiting to be ordered, waiting to be addressed, waiting to say, oh, do this, do that. Yeah? Interesting example is he saw this video, and in this video, it was released for the Queen's 80th birthday. And on this video, it's showing various things in the palace. And one of the things it's showing is how they serve the Queen her meal. You know, big, you know, traditional thing, big long table, candelabras, the whole thing. You know, she's sitting there on her own, this gigantic table, and the servant's standing there, and he's got his head down. He's not looking at the Queen. He's not looking at what she's eating. Yeah? He doesn't speak at all. Right? And then when she wants something, she rings the bell, he comes and she tells him what to bring, and he brings it. Right? There's no speaking. Same as they have this system in the palace there. It's like they have this light system in the corridors. And there's many, in Westminster there's many big long corridors and crossing corridors and stuff like that. So when the Queen's walking down the main corridor, then the side corridors is red lights and tell the servants they can't go. Huh? It's just like the other day when it was Janmashtami, you know, we're taking the deity out from the altar to go for bathing. So then everyone has to stand back and let the Lord come, because this is God. It's not just some, you know, one of the blokes at a football match or something, you've got to sort of push your way through. You know, like we tend to see, you know, people, you know, in order to get somebody, you actually have to elbow your way through or something like that. So the mood there is dasya, and it's in a particular the particular frame of reference that Prabhupada would give is the mood of awe and reverence, is aishvarya. So we see, you know, with the service to the Queen, the mood is aishvarya. So it's the same when we're serving the deity. You know, and when these people have this mood of aishvarya, they get the benefit of that. They have the proper relationship, the proper understanding is we serve the Queen like this, and they keep their job. Or in the olden days, they would keep their head. Yeah. In the olden days, if someone was disrespectful to the king, off with their head. No question about it. No discussion, nothing. Just cut their head off. And very, very, harsh the way they dealt with people previously. Of course, now in the modern day and age, we tend to become a little more, the way things are done, a little bit more sort of liberal, I guess, in the dealings, a little more, concerned about public opinion and stuff like that. And in previous days, kings were, I'm not talking about Vedic kings, I'm talking about non-Vedic kings. They were very, very, they couldn't care about what anyone said. If anyone said anything bad about them, they just have them killed. Very simple. Of course, this is not the Vedic system. It wasn't like that in the Vedic system. The king in the Vedic system actually took the mood of being the father of the citizens, and he would see to their welfare, and he would see that the system of Varnashram was implemented so that they could actually progress and develop nicely in their spiritual life, so they could actually awaken their awareness of their constitutional position as a servant of Krishna. Whereas we see nowadays, generally speaking, that leaders and kings, etc. like that, they see the people as someone to exploit, someone to get more money from or whatever, just to improve their situation. A little bit of a different mood there. Point I'm leading to here, though, is like, as we see the relationship that is there in the mood of servitude or in reverence between king and the servant or queen and the servant, the servant takes this mood. They don't speak to the king, they don't speak in front of the king or queen. They don't, So in the same way, when we're serving the deity on the altar, we need to understand the mood, in order to get the proper effect, in order to achieve the result of performing that process of deity worship. We need to see that, yes, this is Krishna, the supreme original personality of Godhead, Sakshat Hari, directly Krishna. There's no difference between the deity and Krishna. As described in the Bhagavatam, there's five incarnations of Krishna. There's Paravyuha, I don't remember the names of all of them. One of them is Vigraha. So this Vigraha, Sri Vigraha, is an incarnation, one of the five recognized incarnations of Krishna. So when we're on the altar, if we have this proper mood of worship, if we see that this is Krishna directly, and we're always very, very respectful, reverential, always attentive to his comfort, always attentive to see that his needs are being met, and not talking. I had an experience recently. I was in one altar in America, and the pujari was sitting down there, and he was worshipping Govardhan Shila. Actually, I had two or three Govardhan Shilas, and there was someone out in the room you know, where they keep the backdrops, which is kind of like in the next room. And he's yelling out something to him, you know, calling out something to him in the next room. Completely disregarding the fact that he's sitting in front of the same person in front of him. So if we have this kind of approach, we don't actually understand that yes, this is Krishna, I am a menial servant, then we won't get the benefit of the relationship. So we see that in Vedic culture, relationships are stressed. Very important. Just like you see in the modern day and age, you know, the relationship between mother and child, for instance. You know, you often see children, you know, addressing their parents by their first name. I mean, you know, if I had ever had addressed my father by his first name, I would have got a backhander. I'm not saying that's, you know, a valid response, but the point is that, you know, in that sort of era, that you didn't speak to your parents like that. You spoke to them in a very, very respectful way. But now it's becoming more and more common to see that children will argue with the parents. You know, and you see that even now, I think it's becoming more common in Australia, but in England, for instance, the law there is that, you know, the parents cannot, what do they call it, corporal punishment. They cannot hit the children. And there has been cases where the children take the parents to court. And then they become wards of the state. But the thing is, it's like if one actually develops a proper service mentality, or the proper understanding of a relationship, okay, I am a child, this is my parent, this is the way I need to act, this is the way, it's not just the children are losing the understanding of how to act, the parents have also lost the understanding of how to act. As it describes in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, how one should not become his guru na sa 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 that it describes that if one is not capable of delivering their dependence from the cycle of repeated birth and death, they should not become a guru. Guru na sa 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 sa. Nor should they become respectful, superior, worshipful demigod, a king, a father, a mother. Because all these different relationships, you know, unless we're capable of delivering our dependence from the path of repeated birth and death, then we're not qualified to take this relationship. So unless a person is qualified to deliver their children, they shouldn't have children, according to Lord Rishabhadev. Because this is, what he's saying here is, this is the duty of this role. If you are a king, for instance, your duty is to deliver the citizens. That's why Varnashram is there, because Varnashram is for guiding the citizens on the path back to the spiritual, to the spiritual realm, or back to spirituality. You know? So they have their particular Varna, you know, that they're calling in life, whether they're Brahman or Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra. They have that, and they engage in that in a peaceful way, you know, according to their nature. They engage in this activity so they can actually lead them, so this will lead them towards spiritual activities to understand that Krishna is God. This is the duty of the king. Nothing more than that. His duty is not to levy taxes and to exploit people and manipulate people and punish people. That's not his duty. That's something else that comes if people misbehave. But the actual duty of the king is to make the environment such that people can actually develop God consciousness. So it's the same. What's the duty of a demigod? The demigod creates a situation so that people can become God conscious. What's the duty of a parent? The duty of a mother or father is to guide their children on the spiritual path. And that begins by setting the example. So, you know, the same with a guru. What's the duty of a guru? You know, to give like these you know, bogus blessings and have people touch their feet and get their money, you know, and go around hugging them all and things like that. Is this actually what the business of the guru is? No. Lord Kapila says, if they're not capable of delivering their disciples from the path of repeated birth and death, then they shouldn't take these roles. And it's very, very clearly given, you know, in all the scriptures that the role of guru is so clearly defined. And there's no need to misunderstand this. You know, it just means that if someone misunderstands what is the role of guru, it means they're not actually studying the Shastra. You know? It clearly outlines it in many, many, many places. You know, even we see in the what is that? Is it Upadeshamrita? Vachavegam, Manushvaravegam, Jivavegam, Udhapasavegam, Etamvegam, Yogashuhete, this is Sahamahman Prithivim Sasisha. That is Vachavegam, the person who can control the urge to speak. Manasakrodavegam, the actions of the mind, the urge of, the actions of anger. Jivavegam, the actions of the tongue. Udhapasavegam, the belly and genitals. So such a person who can control all these things, he's qualified. Priti means the earth. Sisya, sa sisya. He can make disciples all over the world. So such a person is giving the qualification. And then we see also later in the Bhagavatam, I think it's the 11th canto, it talks about, I've forgotten the verse, but it basically mentions there that anadiviti yuttasya purushasya. Actually, I think I'm missing up two verses there. It's saying that because the person has been in ignorance, anadi avidya, anadi, since time immemorial, he cannot extract himself from this tabernacle of the modes of nature and material desires and the whole thing. It's not impossible. Same thing is pointed out in, I think this is the 5th or the 7th canto, it mentions how Matina Krishna Parato Sato Vadato Vibadeti Kriha Bhutana Matantapo Vishakamta Visham Puna Punas Chavita Javanana. It's a really heavy verse, really describing a miserable situation. Like people who think that sense enjoyment is the goal of life, and look around you. How many people does this count? Everyone counts. Me too. I'm convinced that sense enjoyment is the aim of life. Otherwise, why do I do the activities I do? But somehow I have this intellectual acceptance that yes, if I practice Krishna consciousness, I'll be able to give this up. But my actions speak louder than my words. And you see, watch me do today. You see what I do. I'm always trying to enjoy the time, eat nice Krishna prasad. I've already had myself a burpee this morning. Things like that. Just try to satisfy the time. So it's pointing out there that Matina Krishna, Parato Svatova, they are not capable of affecting their own self-realization. They're not capable of understanding. Matina Krishna, they do not know Krishna, cannot understand Krishna. Parato Svatova, Parato by the help of others, Svato by their own endeavors, ba, or by a combination of both. They're actually caught up in this grihabhakaranam, this vow, this pratana of enjoying material life. Adanta bobi vishatam tamisham. Adanta bobi vishatam tamisham. Very interesting. They're like asses and cows. Just like asses and cows. And you see, I remember one time I was in Vrindavan, and because we hear Prabhupada talk about all these things in the scriptures, and the Gita and the Bhagavatam and stuff like that. I remember one time I was in Vrindavan, and there was these two asses or donkeys there, And Prabhupada talks about, how the donkey he likes to bray. It's actually in the Shastra also, talks about how the donkey likes to bray, and he thinks it's very beautiful singing, ee-haw, ee-haw, ee-haw. That just sounds so painful. Sounds a little bit like Hindi, actually, when you hear people speaking Hindi sometimes, especially the coarser people. And he also talks about how the male donkey, he'll sing like this, and he'll be trying to woo the girl. And he comes to the girl, and he's got his head down like this, he's a little shaking his head, he's all very sort of like coy and trying to entice the girl. And what does she do? Bang! Kicks him in the face with both feet. And he's still down there, he's carrying on, he's trying to attract her and chasing her around. And she does the same thing, kicks him in the face with both feet. So the Bhagavatam is describing how people are like that. They're like asses and cows. They're just going again and again for the sex gratification and getting kicked in the face. And we see this material people getting kicked in the face like, oh God, they're really getting kicked. And I'm really getting kicked too. It's not just everyone outside getting kicked and we don't get kicked. We also get kicked. Why? Because we're trying to enjoy ourselves in the material world. And as long as we try to enjoy ourselves in the material world, we'll get kicked by the material nature. That's her business. That's what she's there for. She's very good at it. She's not an amateur. She's very, very good at it, and she'll kick you so hard. And it's actually, it's like sometimes she's called Durga. And what does Durga mean?
Prison house.
Now, you remember? I don't know if any of you remember Petrie's prison. It was up there in Hobart, I think. It had these big high granite walls, yeah, with barbed wire around the top, and you know the towers and the guys with the machine guns and stuff like that. So if anyone tried to escape, they'd shoot them. So this is the standard concept of prison. But what is the difference between the prison that the, you know, keeps the criminals in, the prison house in the pure world? A very significant difference. There's no walls. There's nothing to keep you here except your own desires. You keep you here because it's such a prison you want to stay here and enjoy it. It's such, you know, it's such a deluding thing that, you know, we think it's so wonderful here that we keep ourselves in prison. It's just like I know in Queensland years ago they had, when I was living up in Queensland about 20 years ago, there was this whole hue and cry in the press about, you know, the prisoners, they're supposed to be in jail suffering. You know, they've got private colour TVs in their rooms, they've got, you know, hot and cold running water, they've got, you know, on Sundays they have their roast dinner and they have this and that. They're making all these demands, you know, and they go on strike and they have these revolts in the prison because they want to get some better facility. But let's do a bit of a reality check here. These guys are criminals. They've been murdering and raping and stealing, and here they are living in the Hilton. You know, they've got such a nice facility there, and when they don't get what they want, they go on strike and have a revolt. And then the government gives them more facility. It's just bizarre. So anyhow, the point that was in that verse is how, like, the living entities how they can continually, repeatedly trying to chew that which has already been chewed. They're just trying to enjoy things more and more and more in this material world. And it gets down to the fact is they don't understand the point of their relationship. They think that I am the material body. Aham the mental. They're thinking like this. I am the material body. I am the controller. I am the enjoyer. That everything here is for my enjoyment. Just look around. You'll see that everyone is like that. When they speak, what is the thing they speak about the most?
Themselves,
exactly. They speak about themselves. But when you listen to, say, a great soul, what do they speak about the most? Krishna. If you listen to Prabhupada, I mean, he, of course he spoke about himself. But most of the time, he was speaking about Krishna. Or I remember I was listening to these, there's these memory seed DVDs out talking about Prabhupada. And I remember, like, I was listening to some of the devotees I was talking about, a little bit about Prabhupada, but most of it was about them. And then one of the devotees I was listening to, I noticed, he talked about Prabhupada. And he didn't talk about himself, he didn't bring himself into the picture, he just talked about Prabhupada. And I just found it so refreshing, so enlightening to hear someone that was just, you know, glorifying Prabhupada without trying to put themselves, yeah, when I was here, Prabhupada came, the first thing they talk about is me. You know, when I was here and Prabhupada came. But the other devotees talk about, well, Prabhupada was doing this and Prabhupada was doing that. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, they're getting the eye out of the center of everything and putting Krishna in the center of everything. They're starting to understand a little bit about the relationship. There's something that I wanted to bring up is I had a quite interesting experience. It's like, you know, at least once a week my wife and myself would go for a walk down to Station Pier and back, and it's about an hour's walk. And I mean, notice something down there. There's a restaurant down there. Really interesting restaurant. You know what it's called? My Dog Cafe. Now, you know what the restaurant's for?
Dogs.
Yeah, it's a dog restaurant. They take their dogs there and they've got all these little, you know, things they serve the dog. They have doggy cappuccinos and this thing and that thing. You know, these people just don't understand the relationship. Another one I saw, we went down to Geelong yesterday, and we were sitting, went to Torquay, and we were sitting in the bus in Geelong, going out to Geelong, and we saw this church, right? Get this one. And it's like, it just never ceases to amaze me how far down the society is sliding. It's got a long way to go yet, by the way. It's nowhere near where it's going to get to. Anyhow, so they had this thing. I can't remember the exact details of what it said. Outside the church, you know, they had the notice board outside the church advertising, you know, the upcoming service. So the service they're advertising is bring your dog, bring your pet to church on Sunday, get him blessed. They're going to bless the dog, the cat, the goldfish, whatever. This is just a ploy to get people to come, because they're seeing that obviously the people in the church have some degree of intelligence, because they're seeing that yes, people are attached to their pets, therefore we'll use this attachment to get them to come to church. But they're bringing an animal into a house of God to get it blessed. They're not actually understanding what is the relationship between a dog and a human. The dog lives outside the house. Dog doesn't come inside the house. If you touch the dog, you should take bath. Dog is an unclean living animal, unclean living entity. What do they do? When they meet another dog, what do? They stick their nose in its backside and have a smell. Is this a cultured living entity? Is this a clean living entity? No, filthy, dirty things. They eat stool. I've seen them eating stool. Dogs are very attracted to eating stool, just like pigs. They like to eat stool. Bidbu Jamye talks about Bidbu Jamye, hogs and dogs which eat stool. The Bible says they do that, they eat stool. Sometimes people have rats. You see them, but these white rats, they crawl around their shoulders, hips through their head, all this sort of stuff, pass you on the back. Oh, see, did you see he passed on my back? It's funny. Or sometimes you see people with their dogs. They're like, the dog's, dog, one person having the other dog is like, he's saying hello to you. Oh, you speak dog language, you know what he's saying? Or sometimes the dog, the dog wants to go here, the dog wants to do this. And come on, it's a dog, Understand the relationship. See, Vedic culture is a very succinct, perfect science. It helps us to understand, I'm a human being. I'm supposed to act like this. The duty of the human form of life is to understand that I am Krishna's eternal servant. This is the relationship. I'm not the servant of a dog. But we see, so many people have become servants of their dogs. So many people become servants of different other types of animals. Of their employer, of this, of that, and become servants of so many things, miss their understanding. What is my position? What is my relationship with this creation? Who am I? This is the basic thing. Like Sanatana Goswami, he said, I can't remember the whole verse, he said, Kainami Tapatraya. The English was, he said, Lord Chaitanya was, he was talking to Lord Chaitanya saying that people glorify me as a great soul, but I don't understand who I am. I don't understand why I'm suffering. There's tapatraya. There's three sufferings in this material world. Everyone experiences birth, death, all they know. No. What is tapatraya? Adiyatik, adibhautik, adidaivik, misery. Everyone's experiencing these miseries. Yet he's saying, I don't understand why I'm experiencing these things. Obviously he understood it, but he was putting himself in the position of other people. And people, they're going through all these miseries in this world, they don't understand why. They think because people are being horrible to them. You see so many things that happen in this world. People are in car accidents, people get shot, people this, people that. All sorts of things are going on. People are suffering like anything and they don't understand why. They just try to blame others. They get into a difficult situation, it's so-and-so's fault. They did it to me. But why did it happen to you and why did it happen to someone else? Because you deserved it. It's as simple as that. Why do we have a body that causes us suffering? Because you asked for it. It's just like you go out and buy a car. And the cars, they use the term a lemon. It's a lemon. And then you blame someone else. But hang on a second. You made the choice. You selected that car. You paid for that car. You made a choice. If you were a little bit more intelligent, you would have got a mechanic or someone to investigate to see if it was actually a good car before you purchased it, because once you purchased it, bad luck, you're stuck with it. So it's the same with the body. You've got the body, bad luck, you're stuck with it until it's finished. Then you take on another body. And just like when you make a purchase of a car, by that transaction of giving the money, you go and you give the paper, you look, I want a red one, I want this, I want that, And guided by the senses, by the colour, by how fast it goes, by the noise the exhaust pipe makes, something like that, Guided by the senses, they select it, and if you give the money, transaction complete. It's yours. Same thing with the body. By your activities in this lifetime, and the consciousness you achieve at the moment of death, this is stated in the 8th chapter of the Gita. I said, Antikala Chamamiva Smaram Makaliyavaram. So whatever state of being, whatever state of consciousness you achieve at the end of your life, according to your karma, you get a body. You purchase that body by your activities, by your consciousness, you've got that body. So if you wind up in a dog body in China, don't complain about it. You asked for it. You know, if you wind up with a wealthy family or something, then that's what you deserve. So you utilize it properly. And so we see that in this world, people are—they're not actually understanding why they wind up in different situations. They don't understand that this is because of my past activities. So we see here that Lord Balaram, he's understanding the relationship. He's acting according to Vedic instructions. You know, these are my parents. I respect them. I bow to them. I offer them my pranam. You know, God Himself is bowing down at the feet of His mother, touching their feet. He bows down at the feet of the elder cowherd and the cowherds and the Vrindavan, offer them respect. He understands the relationship. And when you understand the relationship, the thing functions properly. You know, it's just like, you know, if you understand, you know, you have some tool, maybe a hammer or something. You know? I'll give a good example, actually, a better example. Same thing with a tool. As you know, they have these shifters or these adjustable wrenches, and we can open and close the drawers. So sometimes you see a person may not have a hammer, so he uses that for a hammer and starts to bang the nail into the shifter. But what happens in the end is the thing breaks because it's not meant to do that. Because of not understanding the relationship. Just a simple example. So we see in this world is people don't understand the relationship for things, how they should employ things. Actually, what is the purpose of everything? Everything in this world is meant to be used in Krishna service. This is the function of things. And in this way, a greatly advanced devotee sees everything in Krishna. He sees Krishna in everything because he understands how the thing is supposed to be used. So he knows that actually, you know, like for instance, you may see someone sees an attractive young girl on the street. Right, a young man sees an attractive young girl. What does he do? He thinks, now I can enjoy this person. He's misunderstanding the relationship. And because he's misunderstood that relationship, this desire to enjoy this girl will cause him to become bound up in this material world. Or vice versa, if the girl seeing the boy desires to enjoy the boy, then this will cause the living entity to become bound up in this world, as it points out in the third chapter of the Gita. It describes how work done as a sacrifice of Vishnu must be performed, otherwise work causes bondage in this world. I think it's the end of the third chapter in the Gita. It's talking about how that all our activities we're doing in this world need to be directed for the satisfaction of Vishnu or Krishna. Otherwise, karma bandhana. They lead to our bondage. They cause us to become bound up. Because why? Because we're thinking I'm the enjoyer, but this is actually not my role. This is not my relationship in this world. This is not my relationship with material energy. Krishna is the enjoyer. Ekali Ishvara Krishna, Arasabhya Vritti. He's the only enjoyer. Ekali Ishvara, he's the only controller. Ekali means one. Arasabhya Vritti. And he makes all others dance as he desires. So this is Krishna's role. But if I'm thinking that I'm the controller, I'm the enjoyer, I've misunderstood my relationship. And therefore, there are concomitant reactions that come along with that. But if I understand that, no, Krishna is the supreme controller, Krishna is the enjoyer, I am his servant, I've understood my relationship in this world, I've understood my relationship with the Lord, and therefore it brings about my emancipation. You see? Just by understanding relationships, such a simple thing, and it doesn't just apply to Krishna, you know, me with Krishna, that's a neophyte mentality. There's just me and Krishna. That's a neophyte perception of relationship, or kanista. No, an advanced Vaishnava will understand the relationship with everything. Every single living entity, every single object will understand how these things are to be employed, and exactly how they are employed. And in this way, then every interaction we have with every living entity, every interaction we have with any aspect of material nature, is taking us back to Krishna. So it's interesting here how Lord Balaram, how he's showing, and it points out, it says in the verse, it says that vidivat, meaning according to the Veda. This is science. This devotional service is not some, of course, sentiment is there, but it's not a sentimental approach. It is a very scientific approach to understanding who I am.
and what is my business here? And so it gives us the science of how to utilize everything in Krishna service, including myself, including everyone else. It doesn't mean we use other people. It means we interact with a person in a way that's going to propel them towards Krishna. The whole Vedic society is about propelling the living entity, about connecting the living entity with Krishna. And if we're not doing that, then we're misusing that relationship. And that's why we see, you know, in the fifth canto, it talks about that verse, you know, that one should not take on any of these relationships unless they're capable of delivering their dependence from the cycle of repeated birth and death. And we understand there's only one way to deliver anyone from the cycle of repeated birth and death, and that is to connect them with Krishna. You know, we can't deliver people, personally. What's our capacity? What can we do? And tiny little jiva in this body, what can we actually do? The only thing we can do is show them, there is Krishna, you are his servant. We help them to connect with Krishna. And in this way they'll actually become, they'll be actually using their human form of life properly. And there's another interesting point in this verse which is not sort of emphasized so much here. At the end of the last line it says sannyastakila radhasa, and the transliteration has been translated sannyasta, having dedicated akila, all radhasa, material possessions. So I was reading Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on this morning, and he was pointing out how sannyasta was meaning that they renounced everything, they gave it all up. And he was saying how that, you know, from the day that Krishna left Vrindavan, that the cowherd men gave up dressing and sleeping and eating. They just completely, you know, you see sometimes when a person loses a beloved, someone who's very, very dear to them, they just beside themselves into lamentation. They just don't eat, they don't sleep, you know, they dress themselves, they, you know, get all, you know, ragged and unshaven, just, you know. So the cowherd men were like that. As described, how they became so immersed in an ocean of lamentation and separation from Krishna. And all the residents of Vrindavan, you read that chapter where Krishna leaves Vrindavan, and you see the gopis, they became stunned. They just stood there for days. And it was as if they'd given up their life. So this is also, and we see here, you know, with the relationship that the residents of Vrindavan have, with him, it's like they're just so affectionate. And it says, with voices faltering, with this gadgara gira, with these voices faltering out of love for Balaram. They're just, you know, it's kind of interesting because even though they have this complete, sold out love for Balaram, complete sold out love for Krishna, they still don't give up the externals of the culture, you know, at least in a public forum like that, you know, when all the others are around, that they understand what is the relationship and how I should act. Yet we see here they're saying that their voices, there's so much love they can't even speak properly, you know? You know, their whole lives are just sold out to the Lord. And of course we see that with the gopis, that when they're in intimate situation with Krishna, then all the, you know, the social polities, etc., dispense with, because it's a different situation. But in public, still, you know, they don't come up close to Krishna because they're young girls, it's improper, according to Vedic culture. You know, there's so many things like that. So they're strictly following the culture. And so, you know, very, very important to understand the culture and to apply it in our lives, because as we understand the culture, it will help us. The Vedic culture is meant to help us develop our consciousness, not for any other purpose. You know, like Prabhupada talks as a purport in the Gita, where he talks about how some people use the Varnashram system as a means to exploit other people. But actually that's not what it's for. The Varnashram system is meant to deliver people back to Krishna. That's what it's for. Everything is meant for that purpose. And the more we're able to understand that, then the easier we'll be able to progress in Krishna consciousness. Everything in this world, doesn't matter what it is simply for that purpose. It's simply there for Krishna's pleasure. And the more we're able to understand this, then the better it'll be for us and for others. Okay, so we'll finish up. Any questions or? Sorry, Manoj. People, and that is the way cultured people live. That's just like, you know, second nature to them to live like that. Of course, sometimes we see that the devotional ecstasy was so overwhelming that they lost that consciousness. But generally speaking, in ordinary dealings, they would behave according to culture.
So they were not in ecstasy?
I'm sure they were always in ecstasy. I mean, the residents of Vrindavan were not ordinary people. But sometimes the ecstasy was so great that it overcame their external consciousness. Just like we see sometimes Prabhupada, he would talk about things or he would, you know, different things, and sometimes his external consciousness was overwhelmed by the ecstasy. You know, the devotees are saying that sometimes tears would squirt from his eyes like syringes and things like that. And he would lose external consciousness and he would just sort of, you know, go in, you know, I guess samadhi, we go into samadhi for some time. So sometimes the ecstasy becomes, and it's actually described, this is described in Ekta Devotion, I don't remember the technical term, but sometimes the devotional ecstasy erupts to such a level that it overcomes the normal feeling, the normal consciousness. And we see that, you know, the residents of Vrindavan, sometimes, you know, they would just become overwhelmed by ecstasy of love for Krishna, and then the normal deal, just like when Krishna on the Sarapranim, when he was playing his flute, you know, and the gopis are there, they're breastfeeding their babies, they're cooking for their husbands, they're putting their children to bed, they're halfway through getting dressed, and they hear the flute playing, and they just, they're gone. They just drop the babies, they just leave the milk on the stove, they just leave their husbands, they leave their children, they've got, you know, their cloth upside down or something like that, and they're just off to the forest. So the devotional ecstasy overcame their normal dealings. But in normal, you know, dealings, that's how they dealt, according to Vedic culture. A very cultured society deals like that, whereas we see the society we live in these days, it has no culture whatsoever. They talk about, you know, this culture, that culture. There is no culture. I mean, look at Australia. You call this culture? Yeah. I mean, they sing about it. You know, football, meat pies, kangaroos and holding cards. They sing about things like this and they glorify it. They glorify, I mean, you know, how many advertisements on the television about drinking alcohol? They glorify it. It's the national religion of Australia, practically, is to drink alcohol. Yeah. And go on, you know, beat on some levos and some logs. That's what, you know, I don't feel like that. I don't think that that's what I'm saying. I don't call, you know, but the, you know, like they had those riots a year or two ago in Cronulla. Yeah, that was really Australian. That was the Australian thing to do. Was to go and beat up on some of these people from a foreign country. Just very, very, you know, no culture in this country whatsoever. Yeah, and you see other countries also. You know, they talk about culture. No culture. American culture, no culture. Russian or English or whatever, these places have no culture. If you're talking about culture, meaning refinement of behaviour. They don't have any refinement of behaviour at all. They're very, very coarse. And it's all simply based around making money. And we see, you know, the government, you know, they make their laws in terms of, is this favourable for the economy or not? Just like we look at right now, we're in the middle of one of the worst droughts Australia's ever experienced, and there's all sorts of water restrictions. But if you need to use water to make money, use as much as you like. You can use millions of gallons for hosing down your footpath if you're making money out of it. You can't use water to wash your own windows, but if you're a window washer by profession, you can use the water. So it's all about making money. That's the culture, the dollar sign. But the Vedic culture is completely different. The Vedic culture is about propelling the living entity to Krishna. And so therefore, it's in our best interest to understand the culture and to apply it in our lives. Because then naturally, it just pushes towards Krishna. It helps us to become more refined in our behavior so that when we're dealing with Krishna, when we're dealing with the spiritual master, when we're dealing with these advanced personalities, we know how to deal. We don't have to think about it. We know.
But the second question was, and see how you said that when we sleep, what we think that we just think about ourselves. I was told that if you remember Lord Krishna just before you sleep, and also when you remember him as soon as you get up in the morning, then the whole time will be counted as
Prabhupada would say that if you remember Krishna throughout the day, then it is more likely you will think when you're sleeping. So the whole idea is you look at the activities that Prabhupada encouraged the members of the Krishna Consciousness Society to follow. They were all aimed about thinking about Krishna throughout the day. Just like, okay, we get up in the morning, we come, we have Mangal Aarti, we see the beautiful forms of Radha Balabhara, Jagadosa, Vadamayi, Srishi Kornithai, we sing for them, we dance, etc. like that. Then they're getting dressed, so the pujaris are there, they're thinking about Krishna, they're doing so many things for Krishna. Not that they're just dressing the dolls on the altar, like showing off, I'm showing off my talent, see how wonderful I can dress the deity, see how wonderful I can paint the deity's face. No, see how beautiful Balabhara looks. And see how beautiful he makes this outfit look. You hang up the clothes up in the cupboard, well, they're just cloth, You put them on Balabhara, they look beautiful. Right? Without Balabhara, what are they? So we need to focus, If we can focus everything around Radha Balabhara, and Jagannath goes about recording time, then we become beautiful. Prabhupada would say that. It's just like he says, if you like dressing yourself, then use this propensity to dress Krishna, then you become very beautiful. So the more we're able to focus everything we do around Krishna, the more we become glorified and the more we're able to think of Krishna. It's not like, okay, before I lie down, Hare Krishna, I lie down, I go to sleep and then I think of Krishna. It's not like that. It needs to be like, we become habituated. So after some time, it's second nature. You don't have to think about it anymore. That's what we're aspiring for. This is, rather than my nature to be thinking about my senses, to be thinking about myself, then I just automatically think about Krishna because I become so... Not just that it's a habit, it has to go deeper than a habit, but yes, we need to become so habituated to it, so conditioned, if you like, that this is me. This is what I do. When I think about Krishna. When I talk about Krishna. When I do something, I do it for Krishna. That it's second nature. You don't have to actually make a conscious thought. It's just like, when they're learning a language, right? And so they start to speak. I'm sure, many devotees when they came to Australia, I don't know if you spoke English in India and that, but there's a changeover point. When, instead of like, at one point you're thinking of, okay, this word means that. Like if I want to say, I can't think of if I want to say, for instance, how are you? Then I'm thinking, speaking Hindi, I'm thinking, ap kaise ho. I think, in English you say it like that. But it gets to a point where there's a changeover where the person starts to think in English. And it's the same for any language. You start to think in that language. And people who are multilingual can think in different languages. And actually, there's an interesting story. Gopal Bun story. And so Gopal Bun, the king was always, was it Gopal Bun or what was the other one?
Yeah.
No, there's two of them. There's Gopal Bun and there's another one that Prabhupada will talk about. Not Tenali Ram.
Birbal.
Yeah, because Birbal was a very, very intelligent person. He was the minister, an advisor to the king, Muslim king actually. And so one time this man, he came from a foreign language, and he says, I challenge you to find out what my language is, you know. And he spoke all these Persian and so many different languages fluently. Yeah? And they'll challenge him, trying to do so many different tricks. And then the king, you know, he would always sort of goad Birbal and say, I bet you can't figure out what language he speaks. And Birbal said, this is easy. So he went up to the man and just dropped a brick on his foot. And the man started to swear in his native tongue. Oh, what did you do that for? So even though there's some conditioning, and we can condition ourselves to, you know, to think in a language still, you know, that our native tongue is the one that comes through. But the point I was making there, kind of a little bit different from the story. Prabhupada told some really funny stories. Is that our Krishna consciousness has to be to such a point where it's so deep that we cross over from, you know, thinking, oh, I must think about Krishna, thinking, you know, like trying to condition myself to, we just do it, because that's our nature. So that's what the process of Krishna consciousness is all about, is reawakening that nature. Because actually we are servants of Krishna, that is our nature, that's our intrinsic nature. You know, jivera sarupa hoi Krishna nityadas. But because we have this condition, and we've become so conditioned to such a point that we do think we're the body, we're convinced we're the body. Just like someone who speaks another language, you know. And even sometimes I know devotees now, actually I know, probably some of you devotees know Prabhav from Bengal, you know Prabhav, Prabhupada the son. Anyhow, so when he goes back to Bengal, he was born in Bengal and he grew up in Bengal. When he goes back to Bengal now and he sees his mother, he needs a translator to talk to his mother. Because he can't speak Bengali fluently anymore, because he just doesn't do it. So in the same way that conditioning has happened to us, is that we're here in this material world, we're convinced of the body, so much so that we've completely forgotten we're servants of Krishna. So we need to turn that around and become so conditioned to being a devotee of Krishna, it doesn't matter what happens, I just automatically think in this path. You know, if I see some object of enjoyment, I think, how can I engage this for Krishna's service? Not, oh boy, I'm really going to enjoy this. You know? And we see that Lord Chaitanya, he told Raghunath Das Goswami, you don't try to eat palatable foodstuff, because that's enjoying the tongue. For a renunciate, to eat palatable foodstuffs is enjoying the tongue. You know, and the same for our cooks, you know, when the cooks are cooking for Krishna. They, you know, it's very detrimental to their consciousness to be thinking, well, this is going to be really nice. You know, I'm going to cook this, I'm going to put this in, I'm going to put this in. It's really, really tasty. No, we think, what would Krishna like? How can I cook this in a way that's pleasing to Krishna? There's one nice devotee in Bhaktivedanta Maharaj, a very, very elevated Mataji, saintly devotee actually, saintly person. Her name's Kalangana Mataji. And she makes these milk sweets, these legendary milk sweets. And maybe you don't see them so much in this part of the world, but in the Northern Hemisphere you see these sweets all the time. And they're just unbelievably tasty milk sweets, and just so nice and creamy burfis, and just amazing. And her meditation is, I want to cook this sweet in such a way that it attracts Krishna. That's her meditation, is to try to make this. She, I don't think she even eats the sweets herself. Banumara, she used to be the cook for Radharasa Vihari in Bombay. For years he cooked for those deities. He never ate one single offering that he cooked. He was only cooking it for the pleasure of Krishna. So if we can develop this mentality, if we can develop this approach, you know, then this is actually what's going to push us forward in Krishna consciousness more than anything else. And not that we're trying to do things centered around me. We've got to take the I out of the center of everything and put Krishna in the center of everything. And then our devotional service will become very, very effective. It's still effective to some extent. You know, because it's the nature of devotional service. It's like fire burns, no matter what you do with it. But you know, devotional service, if we're able to put Krishna in the center, then it's much more effective. Anything else?
So you told about that ass, you know, you always get kicked by the
most amazing. I've read about it, but then I saw it, you know, and I was standing there watching this, and all the bridge buses are looking at me laughing. I was just like, wow, this is amazing.
So you told that still even my king and again keep shaking his head. So actually what happened, you know, I felt like, you know, whenever I try to enjoy material world, you know, I get kicked, and I remember for that time, oh, this is what is bad. But after some time, again, okay, if you know, oh, this should be good, this should be good. Why is the tendency of forgetting again and again?
Why do you think it is?
I don't know.
If I tell you something, and say, so if you do this, this will happen. And you go ahead and do it anyhow, and it happens. What does that indicate to you? I don't want to say it because I don't want to offend you, but what does it indicate to you?
It's foolishness.
Huh?
It's foolishness.
Yeah, we're foolish. We're all stupid. if we were, you know, like, we think we're intelligent, right? We really do. We think we're so intelligent. If we're so intelligent, why are we here in this material world? Simple question. Why are we here? Because we're stupid. We've had so many opportunities, you know, to return back to the spiritual world, but we haven't taken those. So the process of Krishna consciousness is about reawakening our intelligence. And that's, you know, because, you know, like just like Prabhupada was saying, you drink milk and it refines your brain tissue, you know, it helps to become more intelligent. He would say it's liquid religiosity. So milk products, this is why milk products have an emphasis, that they help us to refine the brain tissue. All this intoxication, you look at the activities of the society, meat-eating, intoxication, illicit sex, gambling, they dull the intelligence. Just I remember years ago, maybe 25, 30 years ago, I remember seeing this advertisement in Sydney, out sort of central west suburbs. They had this sign, stay home and watch television. And was sponsored by the Sydney City Council. Why? Because television dulls people's intelligence. Yeah, and they can put all their propaganda. I used to listen to this music years ago. I mean, I won't sort of get too much into it. There was this musician, he had this, he didn't like television. He wrote this song called The Slime. And he was talking about, you know, TV and all the stuff that comes out of TV. And he's saying how the government used television as a tool to control you, you know. You have, you know, I can't really see, you have been stuffed into my mold. You know, they just mold your intelligence and condition you to think. You look at advertising, conditions you to think that if you drink this type of alcohol, if you eat this meat, if you dress like this, if you talk like this, if you behave like this, you will be accepted in society. I remember seeing an advertisement like that for Forex years ago. Yeah, it's like it tells you that if you live like this, you do all these things, then you're a Queenslander, you're going to have nice friends, everyone will like you. And people believe it. You know, if I go out and buy this product, I will have bright, shiny teeth. It'll calcify all your teeth, and your teeth will crack and fall out. Yeah? But so many people are like that. They sit at home watching television all day, all night long. The television says, buy this new product. They run out and buy it because they're stupid. They're really stupid, you know. But you know, that's a gross example. But you look in all these examples, we're all doing the same thing. The material energy is telling us, "Here's a nice carrot." Yeah, you know, you've seen the thing. You know, you get the carrot on the stick, you hold it in front of the donkey, and the donkey keeps chasing, trying to get the carrot. It never gets it. Why? Because it's just out of reach. Or the same thing Prabhupada would talk about. It's like, you know, like the donkey, the washerman, right? You've seen these guys, you don't see so much the washerman, but you see in Vrindavan, for instance, you see these guys, they have the donkeys and they load them up with bricks. Bricks are heavy things. I mean, really heavy things. You try and carry 10 bricks at one time and see how you go. 5 is pretty hard. Yeah? They load them up, they have these sort of sacks on their side and they load them up with bricks and they're stacked up. And you look at those donkeys, if they put one more brick on top of that donkey, they break his legs. They're so loaded up, they're shaking. You can see them. They're walking down, they're shaking. Right? And they beat them with a stick to make them go faster. And they're such, like really miserable looking animals, right? And at the end of the day, what does the owner give them? He gives them a handful of grass, which is available on the side of the road. It's growing all. That's all it does is gives a handful of grass on the side of the road and gives the donkey. And the donkey thinks, my owner, he looks after me so nicely. He gives me grass every day. Foolish, you know. It's the same. We go to work, you know, and we're working hard like anything. And you know, some of the stories I hear from devotees about the way, you know, the people at work and stuff, the way they treat them and stuff. They work so hard. At the end of the week, they get their handful of grass, get a little bit of money. Yeah? And it's like that in the material world. You know, we're thinking, you know, that I'm actually enjoying. You know, at the end of the week, I've got a really good job. I get paid $1,000 a week. Or I get paid $2,000 a week. Aren't I lucky? It's just like the donkey. At the end of the week, he gets a little bit of money. A little bit of grass. Because we're foolish, We're thinking that you know, I've actually got a good situation here in this world. But actually, the Shastras tells us very clearly, no, you don't have a good situation in this world. No? Lochan Das Thakur, he describes it's like the drop of water hanging on the lotus petal. The lotus petal moves, the drop falls off. And you see that. If you have lotus leaves, and the rain comes and the rain falls in there, and they've got some kind of wax or something on this, I'm not sure what it is, but the water doesn't actually absorb into the surface. It just sits on the surface. And then when it fills up enough, so it puts the, you know, it's too heavy for the lotus stem to hold, and it goes like that, and all the water falls out. So here we are in this material world, we're thinking that I'm going to enjoy this so much, that I've got such a wonderful situation here, that I'm getting, look at all the things I'm getting, you know. I've got my nice house, I've got my nice car, my nice wife, my job, my this, my that, da, 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 da. You know, so many different facilities. I've got my iPod, I've got my computer. Wonderful life I have. At any given moment, like that, finished. We're thinking, I'm enjoying it. Don't, you know, and that's lack of intelligence. An intelligent person, as it's said in the Gita, will understand the nature of this world, the temporary, miserable nature of this world. But it takes time to develop intelligence. It's not an automatic thing. Because we're so dulled by the material nature, it takes time. And the process of Krishna consciousness is about reawakening the intelligence. That's what it's there for. That's why we chant Hare Krishna. We chant Hare Krishna, it destroys the false bodily concept of life. Prabhupada talks about this in the Gita. Yeah, so then, because right now we have this material intelligence where our consciousness is covered, thinking I am the body. Right? But by destroying that concept, we start to understand, no, I'm not this body, I am Krishna's eternal servant, spirit soul. That's real intelligence. And on that platform, then you can act properly. Once you understand you're not the body, then these things are, these allurements of the material nature are nothing for you. Okay. So, thank you very much. Grantarashima Bhagavatam ki, Shila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhakta Brindaki, Jai Jai Gopremanandi.